When you come in late, you get the best seats. Good to see everybody laughing. We were wondering how we would get you from all over the United States and Canada into one place. The title of today's sermon is Holy Women Pursuing Perfection, and it is about the Proverbs 31 woman. When considering what to present in a forum like this one, teaching the holy women of God, it's important to ask the question, what is needed? What's helpful? What might be lacking? You don't want to go home from an event like this having been entertained. You want to go home being changed, or at least having learned some of the things that will help you to change into the godly women that you want to be. In this symposium, we're presented two different aspects. If this were being given to the world, and you weren't the women of God, for example, we would have all the latest trends and fashions and the latest electronic devices, smartphones, Kindles, apps, tweets, Twitters, Facebook, all those kind of things. But we're blessed with something much, much better than the latest fads, the latest gadgets that are going around. We're blessed with the foundational basics of the eternal principles of Jesus Christ that are written for women. So our biblical text for today is Proverbs 31. You can just keep that one open. If you have a marker, you can put it there. God intends women in the church to be women of spiritual character, fortitude, wisdom, courage, and strength. God really does intend for women to be all they can be. Now, the book of Proverbs contains the unchanging, universal principles. Principles of life, human interaction. Not from our point of view, but from God's point of view. They never stop working because they are eternal principles. They never stop being effective. God is our creator. He knows what makes us tick. He knows what works. There's always something new coming out in the world, but these things never change. Now, the book of Proverbs, as many of you know, is a gold mine, but you have to dig to find the good stuff in there. We thank God for the Sabbath. It's a time to worship God, but it's also a time to look into His Word so that we can become more like His Son, Jesus Christ. Proverbs 31 and verse 10. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her value is far above rubies. God's saying that she is precious in His sight. When you study your Bible, when you look into your Bible, I hope that all of you have come to the point where in your reality, in your identity, you say, this is the way that it is. So this is God's perspective. We find ourselves in a culture that wishes to define the perfect woman for us. And it's far from what God considers a perfect woman. I just jotted down a few things because I've been out of touch with the world for a little while. But it seems that TV depicts the perfect woman as a beautiful winner of the Miss USA pageant or Miss Universe pageant or Miss America pageant. Her skill sets today would include things like martial arts. In my day, she would have gotten up and played a beautiful piano solo or maybe done a dance routine. I don't know, maybe they still do that. But today she's free, unrestrained, unfettered by the rules and by conventional traditions. People want to shun that today. And it's a sad thing because the more they shun those traditional values, the further they get away from God. Seems like the woman today just lives a life of reckless abandon, adventurous travels. She's a woman who has a penchant for alluring men, and she's in touch with her sensuality. She's exciting. Ladies, if you have not yet learned what the problem with that is, that lifestyle, it leaves those women cast aside, like some hull of a shipwrecked yacht on the rocks of a distant shore. It does not lead to happiness, fullness. Today we're going to be looking at special traits and godly characteristics of women from a biblical perspective. What does God expect of holy women today? Women today, even in God's church, are not being taught as they should to become Proverbs 31 women. You need to make that a goal in your life. Read the Bible, what does it say? And say to yourself, I want to be like this. A particular subject that we'll be addressing in this symposium is how to become a godly woman who has come out of the world. How to become the woman who is fulfilled, happy, contented, useful, complete, respected, needed, and loved. In the back of your mind, that's what you want. God tells you how to get there, how to go about it. Let's recognize, first of all, that this is Satan's world and one of his primary goals. Top of his list, chew up women and spit them out. That's what this world does. A virtuous woman is priceless in that her faithfulness, devotion, dedication to the godly life and the fruits of fulfilling her life amount to her God-given feminine role. God made you that way. A virtuous woman lays down her life for those that she loves. She's motivated by a deep, abiding love for God's way, God's truth. That's what she works after. And she'll be in constant competition with the world to do it another way, but she wants to do it God's way. And the scriptures say that money cannot purchase what a virtuous woman brings to the table. And that's the loving care and godly concern that can only be provided by a deeply converted woman. Let's go over to Ephesians chapter 5. Keep your marker there in Proverbs 31 because that's where we're working. The Proverbs 31 woman is more than moral and righteous. She's not just virtuous placed on a pedestal. She is a woman of valor in that she actively and openly demonstrates her godly morality and righteousness in every activity of her life. And she's not ashamed of it. Jesus says, you're ashamed of him, he'll be ashamed of you. Live it. Let it show. Don't flaunt it, but stand for it. The Hebrew word translated virtuous means to be of many resourceful character traits. It connotes having the ability to live the life and the substance and the worthiness to be this woman that God is describing. Let's understand that women are heirs to the kingdom of God, just like men. That shouldn't have to be said, but alas, sometimes it is. It comes across that way. It's been taught by too many pastors that women were somehow lesser citizens and told to submit. I never heard one say heel, but they come close to that. Stay in your place, know your place. That is a totally wrong concept. God has a deep, abiding appreciation for women. He just does. That'll come out as we go through here. I can remember one pastor we had said that all women should submit to all men. And half the congregation took exception to that. In Ephesians 5:21, it says, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. I've met married men who didn't know that verse was in the scriptures. But it does say, submit yourself one to another. That word submit doesn't mean heal. It means make it work out. It has a connotation of bringing things together, making it work for the good in a godly way. If the truth be known, women are even now the children of God, same as men, to be born eternally into the family of God. It's even possible for a woman today, in these difficult days, to live up to these standards of the Proverb 31 woman. Now, unfortunately, even today, all women don't have the opportunity. They don't grow up with a proper understanding of their godly role. There are two extremes. Some women, they don't learn to take the godly initiative, and then the other side of the equation is some women are over the top taking too much. But like all things, it's a matter of balance. But the Proverbs 31 woman is God's ideal, and we'll try to look at it and see, okay, what is God telling us? And it's a never-ending study on your part. It'll take a lifetime to become fully the Proverbs 31 woman. Same for all Christians. It takes a lifetime to fully go on to perfection. No matter how good you get, how righteous you get, how smart you get about the scriptures, Jesus Christ is always towering above us. There's so much further to go. Now, some women think, I'd sure like to get married and learn how to be a Proverbs 31 woman. Well, that's not the way to think about it, because it doesn't work that way. A young lady should put on, she should develop the attributes of the Proverbs 31 woman long before she contemplates marriage. You don't want to get the cart before the horse. A young man does not say, if I ever get married, then I'll be faithful to my wife. Wrong thinking. He should be faithful to her all the days of his life, way before he ever meets her. That's godly character. So studying the Proverbs gives a godly woman a tremendous foundation on which to build. In Proverbs 31, women are very rare on the face of this earth. You don't find many of them. So what does God expect of holy women in today's world? There are not many women, and you meet a lot of people as you go through life on your job, at church, and everywhere. There aren't many women who have set their life's goal to be trustworthy, virtuous, godly. But that's something that we do. Is it possible for a woman in today's culture to live up to the godly standards of the Proverbs 31 woman? Yes, it is, with God's help, with the power of His Holy Spirit. So what does it take for a young lady to grow into the mature woman that God describes here? Proverbs 31 is not speaking about romantic love like in the Song of Solomon. It's more about a mature woman with her life all together, making it work. She's a woman that's mature in mind, spirit, and heart. Today's ladies out in the world have gone off on wrong tangents, and they do find their lives on the rocks. And too many women, I'm afraid, have not been fully nurtured to become all that God intends them to be. Now, physically, all young ladies grow up to be women, but not all women mature in their minds and their hearts and their spirits. Some remain little girls all their lives, and that's because life's choices, environment, where we find ourselves, they weren't conducive to the maturation process that God intends. But it's never too late. It's not. God heals. Young ladies should set a goal for themselves of becoming the modern Proverbs 31 woman. It's a goal that is attainable. A woman should be able to attain her highest potential for two reasons. For this life, for the profitability of this life, but also for the kingdom of God. Because in the world tomorrow, you'll be saying, this is the way to walk you in it. You'll be teaching others. And your life's experience, God's letting you go through those right now to build on. We're going to start off with a world in shambles, and they're going to need to hear what you've learned. So these scriptures show the ideal system that God has ordained. And it's good for us to see it and good to know it. So in God's sight and in ours, a Proverbs 31 woman is priceless. Let's go through these verses and we'll see a glowing tribute to the good woman. First, we'll see that the woman of Proverbs 31 is rare indeed. God speaks highly of her industriousness and her other qualities. Proverbs 31, verse 10, who can find a virtuous or excellent woman? Her price is far above rubies. She's priceless. The heart of her husband, verse 11, does safely trust in her so that she shall have no need of spoil, no lack of gain. This trust in her, that's not talking about her being faithful. Like, I'm going off on a trip. Will she be faithful? I'm going. That's not what this is talking about at all. This verse attests to her dependability and her capabilities. Will she be able to hold the fort down? Will she be able to keep the family together? Will she be able to take care of whatever comes up? That's what it talks about when he says the husband does safely trust in her. So the husband safely relies on her, and he trusts her judgment. She has to become a person whose judgment is trustworthy. The sense of this verse is that because of his reliable and resourceful wife, he's much better off. She's not costing him. He's not being set back when he leaves things in her hands. She makes good decisions. Some husbands erroneously think that their wives are costing them, that she's a burden, that she's holding them back. That's wrong-headed. That's foolish. That's not the way to think. Yes, she's faithful to her husband, but that's not the question here. The husband trusts her judgment. That's a good place to be. He trusts her to make good and right decisions. And what does that do? That frees the husband up to go about his business. He's got a long way to go. We'll talk about that with the Proverbs 31 man. But he can become a greater success in his own endeavors in that kind of a relationship. As you know, there's a difference between our wants and our needs. We need to understand that. As children of God, our needs being met is an eternal spiritual principle. The Proverbs 31 woman is committed to her husband's success even before she meets him. It's not after they get started and know each other. It's a process that she starts in her life, in her mind, with God, while she's yet alone. It says in verse 12, she will do him good, not evil. She's not going to harm him all the days of her life. do him good. It means that she fully justifies the confidence that he places in her. She lives up to it. You put this in your notes. We're not going to turn there, but in Proverbs 19:14, it says, "House and riches are the inheritance of fathers, and a prudent wife is a gift from the Lord." She's intelligent. She's skillful. Women have God-given gifts. They are insightful. They are discerning. They're cautious. They're sensible. They're discreet. They're wise. Those are gifts of God. That's why the scripture says she's a gift from the Lord. Some people are born into wealth. Others work their way up by the sweat of their brow. But a Proverbs 31 woman, the scriptures say, is a gift from God. Not many in this world today are going to attain to it. The wife is the godly helpmate of the husband, a divinely provided helpmate to him. She's a gift to the husband, and therefore, she's a gift to the entire family that will come later. She's the perfect complement to him in terms of personality, managerial skills, talents, and spiritual gifts. If the husband tries to rely on his own abilities only, and you've probably seen it in the Church of God, where the husband just rides herd and keeps the wife stuffed down, if he does that, he's not taking advantage of all the resources that God has given to him. He misses out on a lot. If a husband shushes his wife when she starts to say something, when she starts to speak, in marriage, a man's role is to nurture his wife into being a Proverbs 31 woman. Too many men put a lid, a gag order on their wives, stymieing their godly development. He's stymieing her growth. He's holding her back. And he's throttling his own potential. We could go into a discussion of why does he do that? Is he insecure? Does he want to look good to the pastor? And all those kind of things. That's for another time. But the Proverbs 31 woman and her husband have a symbiotic working relationship. They feed off of each other. They strengthen each other, whereby they achieve more together than either one of them working singly. It's the old spiritual principle that one plus one is more than two. It's three because of God's input. Wives are given insight and sometimes discernment, which men do not always possess. The Proverbs 31 wife is cheerful in her work. And she enjoys what she's doing. She knows quality when she sees it. She sees to it that there's an ample supply of materials and supplies and clothing for the family. Verse 13, Proverbs 31:13. She seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. She's not just a supervisor. She is hands-on. She gets in there and she's fully involved. She considers her household's needs as her highest priority. She's not trying to get away from the family and just be something on her own for her own selfish need. She is building something that godly. And as I said, that begins way before marriage, and it has a lot more to do than just a hope chest full of some sheets and towels and so forth. She is serious-minded. She develops her resources. She develops her sources. She looks for the best bargains. She knows where to shop. It says in verse 14, she's like the merchant's ship. She brings her food from afar. Look, she's not lazy. She works the system. She finds where the good deals are for the sake of her family. And that adds up over the years. It makes a big difference. Here's another one that you can put in your notes. Proverbs 20 and verse 4. The sluggard will not plow by reason of the cold. Therefore he shall beg and harvest and have nothing. So if you have a man and he says, well, I'm not going to work today, he makes excuses, it's too cold to go to work today, the Proverbs 31 woman does not find excuses. She stays after it all the time. She does her duties. Verse 15, she rises also while it is yet night. She gets up, 5 o'clock in the morning, let's say. She gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. And these are extended households. You might say the grandmother and old grandfather might still be in the home. Or there might be adopted children in the home. This is a rather extensive home. In this case, there are maids, servants, farm workers. They're rather large extended homes that are being spoken of here. Portions to her maidens. Yes, she has maids. But it's not because she wants to be waited on hand and foot. A lot of people go, oh, you have a maid? You know, so that you can pamper yourself, sit around and eat bonbons. That's not what's going on here. She has this extra help so that she can do much, much more. You know, housemaids and domestic servants increase the productivity and ability of the matrons of the home if you're doing what you're supposed to. Having extra household help frees up the wife to be of even greater service to the church and to others, even the community. She's able to visit the needs of the elderly and the sick brethren and the poor and the fatherless in the community. She has the opportunity, when she gets her life together, to practice pure religion, as you'd see in James chapter 1 and verse 27. If you're up to here in debt and work and everything's overloading your lifestyle and your life is not together, it's hard to be practicing a pure religion. Your time's just all taken up just trying to make ends meet. As Proverbs 31 woman, she's good to work for. She's a good boss. She's a good administrator. She gives food to her household. It means that even before daybreak, there she is getting the meals together for the day. You know, lunches for the kids. Maybe she packs something for her husband, or getting everything lined up for everybody, or for supper tonight. She's thoughtful in her planning, her execution. She shops, she compares, she watches trends, she finds the bargain. She's not wasteful. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. Do you see the freedom that this woman has? She considers a field and she buys it. Women have a real knack for real estate. When I was a young man, it seemed like all the men had the real estate careers. You never saw a woman in the field. And today, from my perspective, it seems to be dominated by women. God gives women a gift. It says so right here in the Bible. She considers a field and she buys it. My wife, Sharon, mother of four, grandmother of a dozen, she found some real good deals on houses that we've lived in the past. And we always made a handsome profit when it was time to move on. We recognize that it was God's principles that made that possible. But Sharon put me and the entire family of six through Ambassador College on the profits of the house deals that she put together. And there's no way, I don't have that talent. I just, when I see a piece of land or see a house, I either don't know, don't care what it's worth, it doesn't ring my bell, doesn't strike me. But she sees a good deal and she goes, that's a good deal. Need to get in it. And we'll be able to get out of it and turn a profit. And that's a gift. Men, I'll just tell you right now, we ain't got it all. God gives women special gifts. She considers a field. She buys it with the fruit of her hand. She plants a vineyard. That doesn't mean that she goes out and plants the little grape saplings. What it means is that she takes her profits and reinvests them, and she's reinvesting them wisely. She's not just a dope sitting there being dumb and happy. She's really working, thinking, planning ahead. In other words, she invests for the future wisely. She takes care of herself physically. She maintains her health with enthusiasm and eagerness. Verse 17, she girds her loins with strength and strengthens her arms. That means that she develops the talents that she has. Those things have to be worked on. They come as gifts of God, but they're to be developed, honed, sharpened. She keeps her mind clear. She keeps it straight. She keeps her eyes open. In today's world, she would be sharpening her computer skills. Maybe she would be bilingual, or maybe even learning a third language. This world is moving fast, but she develops her God-given talents. She has a good eye for opportunity. She works long hours. She plans for the future. She keeps the home fires burning, as they would say. She is hospitable, and folks welcome her anytime, and she welcomes them into her home just the same. Verse 18, she perceives that her merchandise is good. Her candle, her lamp, goes not out by night. This word perceives is an interesting word in the Hebrew. If anybody's a Hebrew scholar out there, I'm not. It's ta'am, T-A-A-M. But it means she can taste it. Have you ever heard somebody say, I want victory so much I can taste it? There's a scripture like that. Psalm 34, verse 8, you can put it down. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusts in him. So she can taste victory. She can taste that if she does these things, great success for her family, her husband, her future kids. When she's young, middle-aged, and older, will come. She can just taste it, is what that verse means. She doesn't boss people around. She's courteous. She's gentle, one of God's gifts to women. And yet, she's firm no nonsense when it comes to these things. Verse 19, she lays her hand to the spindle and her hands hold the distaff. It means that she's using the latest technology available. She's not wasting her time spinning her wheels, so to speak, not going anywhere. Like she would have the best sewing machine to dress others. I don't know how much it's done today, but my wife made all of our shirts and for me and the boys, and dresses for the girls. I met a lady yesterday in God's church that made suits for her husband and her son. She had a couple of sons. I don't know anybody that makes suits. To me, this is beyond what you can do on a sewing machine, but she did it. Now, that was almost a century ago. The Proverbs 31 woman sets an example with her work for others to measure up to. She sets the standard for her household. You don't always say to people, you go do it, and I'm going to sit here and watch TV, or you go fix the supper, you go make the beds, I'm going to stay in here and chat with my friends or something. She sets the example. She's generous and she's helpful to her staff. She's not self-centered like it seems the way of this world is today, because women are self-centered. Too many people today, it seems like they're a god unto themselves. The world revolves around them, what they want to do, what they think, what they have in mind, and they're putting everybody else. It's a tool of Satan, but that's not the way that it should be. When women make it all about themselves, about their careers, they don't realize it, but they're limiting their own personal overall potential and development. Now again, a Proverbs 31 woman is not born that way. She's not born with all these developed skills and traits. They have to be worked on. It does take character building. It does take sacrifice. A Proverbs 31 woman is developed. It takes a lot of work and diligence on her part. She has compassion for the poor. She's generous. Notice verse 20. She stretches out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. That's a New Testament concept, taking care of people that are less well off than you are. Have you ever noticed in the Church of God, it seems that those who have the most burden, the greatest responsibility on their shoulders, are the ones that show up when it's time to serve or work or put something together. They're the same ones who find or make time to serve God's people. I'll turn over to Proverbs 11 for just a second. Keep your marker there. I want to go over to that concept about one and one's more than two. Believe it or not, one of the reasons that a Proverbs 31 woman does so well is because of her generosity and her kindness. This is something that the world can't get its mind around, but it's an eternal principle of God. You can try it. You can go to the book of Malachi where God says, try me, test me, prove me, and see if I won't pour out on you more than you can handle it, it says. Proverbs 11 and verse 24. There is that scatters. Okay, there's a person that scatters. There's a person that gives to the poor is what this is talking about. And yet increases. Now, that's not the way you learned it in math. If you have eight apples and you start giving them away, you have less apples. That's not what this verse is saying. You give it away to the poor and you increase. You have more. And there's also that there's a person who withholds more than is meet, more than is correct. So here we have a stingy person that's trying to keep everything. And what happens? They tend to poverty, it says in verse 24. See, that's that spiritual principle again. There's a spiritual component in generosity. And you can see it on a macro scale as well. Look at the United States of America. Why have we for 200 years been so rich on the face of this earth while third world countries remain so impoverished? It's that same principle that you see in Proverbs 11 and verse 24. And to the world, that principle seems backward. To the unconverted mind, it's backward. But it's not backwards because of godly love and the way that God works. You cannot outgive God. The Proverbs 31 woman is not easily deterred from her duties. Some people almost fall into a habit of looking for excuses to get out of work. She's ready, she's prepared for whatever obstacles come her way. It says in verse 21, Proverbs 31 and verse 21, she's not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. Okay, that word scarlet sort of has a double meaning. It can mean red, scarlet, like we talk about, but it also has to do with a double thickness. Her family's well-dressed for the cold. It's one of the things that she's doing, one of the many, many things. Just being prepared, being very practical, or they're prepared for any occasion. Some people, when they read Proverbs 31, they say, this woman is way too materialistic. You know, there's nothing in the scriptures that says, on God's part, I want you to be poor, I want you to be barefoot. Sometimes you get that feeling in the church and in other places. But God wants you to have, as he puts it, the fat of the land. He wants you to have the good things. He wants you to prosper above all things. We don't have time to go there today. Put this in your notes. I want you to look at how God adorns his bride in Ezekiel 16. And you've read it before, but she wears the finest embroidered work, mink, jewelry, all the best. You can read down through there. Proverbs 31, verse 22. She makes herself coverings of tapestry, bed coverings. Her clothing is silk and purple. She has quality in her life. And that adds to her character, and it adds to the respect that she has. She hasn't stolen it. She's worked for every bit of it. And at the same time, she's loving, and she's giving. She's committed to her family. When she marries, she's committed to her husband's success. She wants him to be a success. They're a team. They work together, serving, helping one another, submitting to each other in the fear of the Lord for the benefit of everybody. You can read about that back there where we had Ephesians 5, and it tells why you submit to one another. She has stability in her life, and she adds stability to the lives of those that she comes in contact with. When someone else is down, she can lift them up. When somebody else is sick, she helps them. When someone needs encouraging, she can be there. Okay, maybe some of you are thinking, yep, I'm just a woman, and I get down, and I get tired, and there's nobody there to help me up. Yes, there is. God's looking out for you. He's not going to give you more than you can handle. Even though I did learn that, well, in fact, one lady told me, she says, you know, when you have these terrible trials and you think, I can't take any more, God knows you can take a little more, and here it comes. But God's looking out for you. She respects her husband. He's the head of the family. And he is making every sacrifice for the family, just as Christ has done for us in the church. In the same way, she too submits herself unto her own husband as unto the Lord in a godly way. This message wouldn't be complete without looking at Abigail. Let me turn over to Abigail for just a second. 1 Samuel 25, you can put another marker back there if you have another marker. You know who Abigail is. She was one of King David's wives. In fact, of his wife, she's my favorite. I like her personality. I like her get up and go. I like her foresightedness. I like the Proverbs 31 aspects of her life. And indeed, she was being a Proverbs 31 woman when it was difficult, when it was really hard to be a Proverbs 31 woman. Because what was she up against? Anybody know? Her husband was a fool. He wasn't up to par, let's put it that way. He was a bad egg, okay? We first meet her as a resigned and tolerant woman in a very challenging situation that took great wisdom and love on her part because of her foolish husband. In fact, his name, Nabal, means a fool. She also dealt brilliantly with David. He was a military leader, very powerful. The future King David, who was angry at her foolish husband for his offensive treatment with David and his men. Abigail was a godly woman of good behavior, attitude. She was a beautiful woman in the way that she conducted herself. I try to think back to what it would have been like in those days. Life must have been so very much harder than it is now. No electricity, no running water. I'm sure dirt floors in a lot of cases. When the Bible says here in 1 Samuel 25 that Abigail was of good understanding, it meant that she had a good deal of godly wisdom and fortitude. In a rude and condescending fashion, Abigail's husband, Nabal, he snubbed David's request and he sent the messengers away empty-handed. Upon learning about this foolish and potentially deadly blunder that her husband had committed, Abigail prepared and hurriedly delivered a substantial store of foodstuffs and provisions to David as a peace offering. She couldn't have done that if the barns had been empty, if the shelves had been bare. She was working. She was preparing. She was getting ready for next year. But because she was a Proverbs 31 woman, she was able to meet this very potentially destructive force that was about to come upon her, her husband, the whole household, and everything. As a Proverbs 31 woman, Abigail, she covered for Nabal's blunders. She saved the entire household when he was negligent. See, that's being a Proverbs 31 woman. That's putting on the pants. If somebody, that woman runs that family. She was being a Proverbs 31 woman. And she needed to be more than most in this situation. I don't know how she found herself in that situation. Maybe she was a child bride. You know, we'll find out someday how she found herself in such a mess. But she demonstrated leadership, maturity, and wisdom, discretion in diffusing a potentially deadly situation. Her example as a Proverbs 31 woman made a deep impression on David. You know the rest of the story. When Abigail returned home from her successful mediation effort with David, she was confronted with another challenge to her skills because of his oppressive, angry treatment. Nabal, he wasn't an easy man to live with. You know the story. We read in verse 14, one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, and he railed on them." Nabal was totally unreasonable and unappreciative of David's protection. And the young man realized that Nabal had made a terrible mistake. He went to warn Abigail of the coming trouble. He knew how Nabal acted. He knew that Abigail's going to fix it and take care of things. In fact, by going to Abigail, he saved his own life and that of everybody in the household. I wish we had time to study the whole life of Abigail as the Bible reveals it. Verse 18, 1 Samuel 25:18, "Then Abigail made haste." Say to yourself when you read this, only a Proverbs 31 woman would have been this wise, this intelligent, this resourceful to put this together. Abigail made haste. You know, she had to work fast. Took 200 loaves, I guess that's bread, two bottles of wine, those big bottles, 5 sheep already dressed. That's a lot of meat around the house. It must have been a pretty big household that she was running. Ready to cook. 5 measures of parched corn, 100 clusters of raisin, 200 cakes of figs. There's a big grocery list right here. It's like a warehouse list that the Bible records for us. And laid them on the donkeys. Abigail sent a veritable truckload of food to David. Who today could put together a stash like that at a moment's notice to save their family? I guess that was their insurance of the day. You know, they didn't go to State Farm and those kind of things. But at a moment's notice, I'm impressed. Obviously, some very serious planning, saving, working, storing had been an ongoing process with Abigail as a rule, as a Proverbs 31 woman. David fully intended to wipe Nabal out, lock, stock, and barrel. He was angry. This is sinful conduct on David's part. He lost it. He wasn't that close to God at this time, other times in his life. He was going to kill all the men, the women, the children, Abigail too. 1 Samuel 25:23. "And when Abigail saw David, she hurried, she hasted, and she lighted off the donkey, and she fell before David on her face, and she bowed to the ground." How would you describe Abigail's heart here? Yielding, conciliatory, submissive, appeasing to David, respectful. She's quite a woman. Brethren, the people who do not understand the principles of God that are at work here, sometimes they see Abigail as a rebellious, non-submissive wife, you know, going around her husband's back. You have to be wise. What would God have her do? Let's examine the full meaning of God's intent. What we see is that Abigail not only saves her husband, Nabal, she saves the whole family, the whole household. She saves David. She saves David's life, whom she knew. And I've done a Bible study, and I'm not even satisfied with how she knew that God had such great plans for David. But you can put it in your notes, verse 30 of this. We don't have time to go there. She knew that he was destined to be the king of all Israel and that God had great plans for him. And that's the way she was conducting her life. And so she saves David from making a horrible error that would have destroyed his reputation and destroyed his life and his future. And the plan of God and Christ came from that lineage. It's a big, big deal. And interestingly, Abigail takes the blame for letting things get out of hand at her house. She doesn't lay it off on her husband. Now, that's a big thing. I hope when you read and study these Holy Scriptures, you're always seeking the higher spiritual meaning of these verses. This isn't just a story that happened way back in ancient Israel when David lived some thousand years before Christ. In the same way that Abigail took blame for Nabal, there's a type there. Jesus Christ took blame for us. He paid for our sins. Abigail's a type of Christ if you study this out completely. In the same way that Abigail knew that God would set David on his throne of Israel, we know that God the Father is going to set Jesus Christ on his throne. 1 Samuel 25 and verse 39. And when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord that hath pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and hath kept his servant from evil, for the Lord hath returned the wickedness of Nabal upon his own head." And David sent and communed with Abigail to take her to him to wife. They were straightforward in those days. I want you to send an email. Come. Come be my wife. Verse 41. She arose. She bowed herself. This is beautiful. Look at verse 41. She bowed on her face to the earth and said, "Behold, let your handmaid be a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." The lowliest, humble position. Look at how powerful she was in her own household, and yet she's willing to come to David and not just be one of the servants, be the servant's servant. And she's sincere. She's going to David with this attitude. Only a servant's servant. Again, Abigail's a type of Christ, that right attitude. And see, church brethren should have this kind of attitude. I'm going to throw in one last thing. I've got to go off on this tangent. But we have a wrong concept in God's church, and it's deeply ingrained in us. Those of you, I'm sure some of you go way back to worldwide days, of the minister being the big guy, you know, the three-piece suit and the big car, and he blows into town, he calls all his shots, tells everybody what to do, and works a schedule, and he's out of there. That is not the kind of servant that a minister is supposed to be. That word minister, we've ruined in our heads when we think about it. A minister is a servant. Or just as Jesus Christ, you know where Jesus Christ came from, seated at the throne of glory with his Father? That's his rightful position. That's where he belongs. He didn't just come to this earth, but he came to this earth. He got down on the floor. He washed the disciples' feet. He was a servant of servants. And he said to you and to me, "Do you likewise?" So that's what Christianity is about. You can see that if you go through these beautiful, beautiful stories. And I've run out of time and I have not run out of notes. Yes, I'll read a couple of comments. This one here is most appropriate. It's about the message that we had today, especially with Proverbs 31 and Abigail and so forth. And this person writes, "These principles should be set in modern-day times." I agree with that 100%. Our job is to translate what God's eternal principles are back then. You're not going to go out and dry figs and get your donkey and all of that kind of stuff. That's not what we do. But the principles are still there. I'll just read this. "These principles should be set in modern-day times." In other words, women today have to work, take care of themselves, while also committing to being a virtuous woman. She's not just a compliment to a man, but to all of those around her. She's self-sufficient, caring. She's the breadwinner even. You're talking to a lot of singles that have been married and divorced, and they're raising children on their own. They're working and serving God. Most women today do not have the privilege to stay home. The modern day is so much different than what we just saw in the Scriptures. Abigail took charge where her husband lacked. So should we do this in this day and time? Men do not take charge in a godly way in most situations. You have to earn respect to get respect. God does not respect those who do not love him. Overall, a woman should respect a godly husband. Appreciate that. I had the wonderful opportunity when I was at Pasadena to teach at Imperial School and teaching 10th graders some of these concepts before they made all the mistakes that we made. At least they got to hear it one time. Go this way and you'll avoid a whole lot of trouble. But it is. It's a time of preparation. Even for those of you who are parents, you cannot start too soon. Everything that you do in your life is teaching your children. And be frank with them and be bold and tell them, you know, it's a wild world out there and you have to be close to God from the time you're a young lady or a young man. Thank you. Okay, the first one that I pick up is, are there any suggestions on how to get to know others over long distances today? My first thought is that God has provided the internet and email and those kind of things, Skype and a million of them, Twitters and tweets and all of those. I just wrote to one of my granddaughters at summer camp last week, and I said, do not get out of there without getting the email addresses of your friends, because you get home, and how do you get in touch with them again? And so I suggest the same thing to you big kids. Get people's email addresses. Anybody that would want to remain anonymous, you have every right to do that. But if you could provide the emails, and maybe just the singles form is one way to get started. But yes, telephone calls and emails in this day and time, I keep it private. I personally don't like blurting my life out over the entire internet for everybody to see. In fact, we're always cautious when we leave town for a long period of time. I am announcing to the world that I'm going to be gone for a week. You can back your 18-wheeler up to the front of my house now. We won't be back until the 8th. I'm a more of a private person, and that's the kind of relationship that you're looking for when you're looking, dating, questioning, growing situation. You probably have a better feel. Any suggestions from you folks to each other as how to initiate, first of all, or continue and maintain a relationship in this culture? And then there's another comment here. And I want to get back to this one here, and I think this is where you will do a better job than me. I know that it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to be a modern Proverbs 31 woman when you have to get the oil change, you have to pay the electricity bill, you have to get the kids to school, you have to find sitters and a million other things. What works is the godly principles, the putting God's principles first. You still don't lie. You still don't cheat. You still don't steal. Even if you go hungry, you don't do those things. You do get up early. You do not pamper yourself. You do dress appropriately and modestly. And you do get yourself to church on time. And you do say your prayers, even if it's the last thing you say on your pillow before you go to sleep. But you draw near to God. It's going to be very creative and inventive on your part in this world, and as Satan comes along, we're going to talk about that in this afternoon's messages, the challenges facing, especially young people, in these times when men's hearts are going to fail them. It's about to get really bad. We haven't got there yet. So yes, anyone want to comment on how to be a Proverbs 31 man or woman in today's world? One of the questions has to do with the verse that we saw about he trusts in her and her being faithful, and the different concepts that go with that faithfulness. The first one that we saw where he trusts in her, it meant, if you study it out, he relies on her. He doesn't have to go back and check and see if she did what she was supposed to do. She's good about taking care of things. That should go with any relationship. At work, if your boss gives you something to do, he shouldn't have to come back and find out, did you do it or not? You're a faithful servant at work and you do what you're supposed to. There's a greater connotation about unfaithfulness in the Bible that plays off the allegories of husband and wife or faithfulness in that way. And it points to the higher spiritual concept of being faithful to God. In this day and time in which we live, there is a great deal of idolatry even within the Church of God. We don't see it. We're told to examine ourselves before Passover each year. So we start with the commandments about no images before me and I'm the only God, and go, okay, we just skip over those and get to the real ones about not lying, stealing, cheating, and we skip over them. But they're most important. Anything that we do that we set a higher priority on rather than the things of God is actually moving God to second place, and that's improper. So that's something to work on in your mind. The question is about not being faithful to God or your future mate, but how to be faithful to God in today's climate, and how to be faithful to God at church. Unfortunately, Herbert W. Armstrong started in, what was it, 1927, and he had the Plain Truth in the 30s, and then radio, and went around the world. But somewhere in there, things started to go off. By the time Mr. Armstrong died, and we went into apostasy and everything, the church got off base. And to my way of thinking, we never went back as a greater church of God to be the true people of God, putting God first. And now we have all these substitutes for religion. We have all of these things that we do for godliness, righteousness, holiness, and those kind of things. And they can amount to not putting God first. For example, you keep the Sabbath. You don't eat pork chops. You go to the feast. You know the scriptures. I could make a long list of things. That doesn't make you a Christian. I wasn't describing you. I was describing the Jews. They're not Christians. They're not converted. They keep the Sabbath. They don't eat pork chops. What is it that makes you a Christian? What makes you have a unique relationship with God? How are you a child of God? We'll talk about a little bit of that this afternoon. But this faithfulness to God is a big, big concept. And we need to not have men, people, groups, organizations, corporate, political, otherwise, between us and our relationship with God. Those are things that we need to get back to the basics in God's church. So it's a very, very deep question about being faithful to God. And it's the same thing with your future mate. If you want to be faithful to your future mate, you become a man of God, and you do everything that God says. That's being faithful to your future mate. I didn't mean to go to preaching, but that always happens.
Oh, boy. Well, it all started in the fourth grade. Warren and I were dance partners in square dance. Then he went off to the seminary. He got real holy. And I was busy at home learning how to be a mother. And my mother worked at the seminary that he was going to. And he came home one day because the priest couldn't bring a woman in the car without another man being in there. So I was standing at the door waiting for my mother to come home. And there she was, there Warren was in the back seat of the car with blonde hair. And then I met him again when we went to college. He went to LSUA first, and then I came second. And he was standing on the campus of LSUA, and he told the guy that he was standing next to, he saw me walking across campus, he said, "That's the girl I'm going to marry." I had no idea. And he asked me out on a blind date because we didn't really know each other, even though we did, you know, in the fourth and fifth grade. I had heard of him. And he asked me out on a blind date. He had another girl call me. And I accepted, but I didn't like him.
It's understandable.
I said, "Well, this is somebody to date, you know." And I just looked at him and I went, "Ugh." And so we started going out, and he pursued me and pursued me and pursued me. And then one night, after we had been dating about 3 months, he says, "Can I try on your graduation ring?" And I went, "You're not getting my graduation ring. You can try it on." So he puts it on his little pinky, and he goes about to his first knuckle, you know. And then, without me knowing it, he pulls out another ring, and he sticks it on my finger. It didn't give me back the graduation ring. And so we said goodnight. And I went into the house, and I was getting ready for bed, and I was turning off the hall light like this, and I went, oh, a ring. He put a ring on my finger. It was an engagement ring. It was just a precursor to the engagement. But he gave me a black and white pearl ring, which I still have. And we began dating steadily after that, and that was it. Yeah. About 2 years later, about a year later, we got engaged. And then 2 years later, we couldn't stand it. We had to get married, and that was it. And it was, you know, one kid after another.
We were good Catholics.
We were good Catholics. And Warren was going to college, and I was working to put him through college, and I was pregnant at the same time. And then I'd quit to have the baby, then I'd go back to work and get somebody to take care of the baby. Then after about two or three babies, we decided, well, that wasn't working because, you know, it was taking away from the family. So Warren got a real job and then went to work at night. He worked during the day and then went to school at night. And then, in 1967, he got his first degree in college. And he started his own business and went on from there, and here we are. We went to Ambassador College, and here we are.
You know, it's hard to tell when you go from meeting somebody to liking somebody to being friends to falling in love. And I don't really know. That's a good question. When did it take place? You know, when did it click? When did we become one? On that very first date that we went out on, it was a school social, a talent show kind of a thing. And Sharon was one of the singers. She sang the whole time. She was in high school and in college and then in the church and then at the feast and everything. But what was the name of the song you sang on that first date?
Hawaiian Wedding Song.
Okay, the Hawaiian. Is this the little boy?
Hawaiian Wedding Song.
Is this the little boy? How does it go? How's it go?
Oh, I don't know.
Anyway, I think we were double dating because this buddy of mine from college, his name was Clyde. He was sitting next to me while she was singing on the stage, and she gets up there and she's up there singing to a group like this, and he's hitting me like this with his arm. He goes, "She's looking at you the whole time she's singing. She's looking at you." And so I fell in love that, you know, on the first date. That's what guys do. I don't know how it is nowadays, but I dated three or four girls before Sharon. And sometimes I dated them twice or three times. I was deeply in love with every one of them. When you're 17 years old, you know, you see a pretty girl and she smells good and she looks good.
His mother bet him a quarter that he wouldn't stay with me.
Brought out the mercenary in me.
He won a quarter.
But I don't know when I first fell in love with her. I don't remember
really
that.
We didn't know what love was.
You grow. And here's something. When you're 17, I'll admit, we were dumb, stupid, backwoodsy. And we're from a little agricultural town, central Louisiana, and you don't know anything except Catholicism, and that's a big part of your life. And then when you come in to God's church, when you're called out of the world, I heard Mr. Armstrong in 1964, and you start learning about there is no Trinity, and you tithe, and you learn the different things. Then you throw away the only thing that you knew, you know, Catholicism, but we went through that together, and so our whole life has just been what we used to be, which was totally different, and going through being called in conversion to become who we are. So I don't know when you fall in love. I was thinking about that when I was looking at Abigail. What kind of love did Abigail feel for Nabal? You almost think it's just like I love my job kind of love. You know, it couldn't have been much deeper or sentimental or emotional than that. You know, you just get out there and do your job.
I probably have fallen in love more recently with my husband than I ever have. We've been married for 50 years.
Next month.
Yeah. And all through our married life, I mean, we were raising kids and, you know, just struggling to make a living and struggling with joining the church and, you know, what is this all about? What is love all about? I don't guess I've really learned what love was all about till we joined the church.